Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. If you're like me, you always love stories about the unusual, the paranormal, the spooky. And I know it's not Halloween time, but I'll tell you what, we are going to hear some phenomenal stories about an area of country in the U.S., Savannah, Georgia, that is absolutely captivating on so many different levels. Either that or it's going to scare you to death, who you'll never go down to visit. But let me tell you, it's beautiful, beautiful country. And I want to welcome to the airways Tobias McGriff. He's put together a book called Savannah Shadows, Tales from the Midnight Zombie Tour. Hi, Tobias.
Hey, thank you for having me.
It is more fun going through your book, because I think telling stories about ghosts and various aspects of history, no matter where you go on this planet, you're going to find something in the way of a legend, in the way of a unique tale, if you will, about odd happenings. How is it that you decided you were going to pursue this as a career? I mean, this is fun. It really is a lot of fun. What, Tobias, made you decide you were going to get involved in the exploration of the paranormal?
Well, honestly, I kind of feel like I was, it was almost fateful. I kind of feel like I was, you know, deputized to do it. I have an engineering background in engineering. And, you know, most people tell ghost stories when they're young and then they grow up and get a job. And I actually got a job and then started telling ghost stories later, which is actually the way I prefer it. But it actually happened with me coming to Savannah and other cities around the southeast part of the U.S. doing research. And I was submitting content to reality paranormal programming, story development, things of that nature. And Savannah obviously was a staple stop in those endeavors. And over the course of years, I just started doing so much research that eventually I realized that, you know, I had a lot of stories to tell that, you know, for all the good, you know, tours that we have in Savannah, I did see some gaps. And the demand was there in terms of people seeming to like what I did. And I decided I was ready for a change. So in August of 2010, we decided to take it full time and give it a try. And so far, the response has been nothing but positive.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, I think sometimes people love being scared to death if they possibly can be.
Sure, yeah,
really,
absolutely.
I mean, look at the success of horror films and all kinds of things. But I want my audience to know a little bit about you. You are a participating member of the Rhine Research Center in Durham, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you've done a lot of research on the paranormal and haunted history of the southern U.S. Mm-hmm. And you have got your own radio show, which is the Savannah Paranormal on
mm-hmm.
WTKS. And, of course, your tours have been given a very, very high rating by different guide groups. When you put this together, you have some wonderful stories, and I loved your story about your friend Mark. I mean,
yeah.
He sounded like such an odd duck. Would you talk about Mark?
You are the first person to ask me about Mark, but it's one of my favorite subject matters in the book as well. Mark actually, he just stayed with me for a couple of months here in Savannah, helped me work on some projects, and you know, Mark is one of those guys that, you know, he got what's commonly referred to as a download when he was in the Southwest United States, and it really changed him. And he is the best researcher. He's far better than I am at researching material. And in fact, so often I rely on him to actually polish off what I do. But he has no interest in being in the public eye. His idea of, I feel like I'm doing what I was kind of meant to do. And for him, You know, it's getting a membership to the Lost Dutchman so that he can pan for gold and, you know, drive around in a pop-up camper around the country, just kind of, you know, staying and doing his own thing. But he's a fascinating guy, one of the smartest people I've ever met. But, yeah, the experience in the Southwest absolutely changed him. He was around Chaco Canyon, where I believe the Anasazi tribe, you know, had so much of their history located. And he's never been the same since then. Not in a bad way, just he's just a different guy.
Well, it does make a change in a person, because when you have a download, we have more than one member in our family that has had experiences, and I know my mentor many years ago, she had an experience out in Palm Desert where there was a download of information, and when you have that happen to you, you don't forget it. It stays there. It makes you aware that there's a lot more to life, to living, to experience than what you have been taught in everyday societal situations. And it causes a paradigm shift in your thinking. You cannot possibly look at life the same way. It just isn't going to be that way. It just can't happen. And I think anybody that gets into the work like you do, and what Mark's experience was regarding the download, it does transform you, and you many times, I think, as an individual, one becomes very conservative, because if you talk to the average person, they'll say, oh, what horror film did you watch last week? Or what Star Trek special? What they don't realize is that this is an actuality, that there's all of this information that's out there. And when you do get a download, you are forced. You are literally forced to recognize that there is far more to life than what you realize. You have so many interesting stories in your book. You've got to talk about the hag. I think the hag is just really interesting, and it had a significant impact on you. Who's the hag?
Well, for sure, yeah, it definitely had an impact on me, and it's one of the more popular things I talk about, and it's definitely one of the most transferable things I talk about on the tour. And it was amazing to me that when I was confronted with my first experience with one, and in the book, as you know, we refer to the story, And Then She Melted is the name of it. I thought I was the only person on the planet that had ever experienced anything like that, because I had never heard of it. But now, in hindsight, I've realized that when I tell the story on the tour, that it is by far the most relatable one that we discuss. And the hag seems to be, I guess the best way to describe it is a little cliche, but I think it's fitting, is as a psychic vampire. It seems to live off the unhappiness of people. I've started referring to it as, if you've ever wondered what the 9-foot shadow at the end of your bed is, you know, it's the hag. You know, in other parts of the country, you'll hear it referred to as things like shapeshifter, shadow people is another very common term. But you know, this thing goes back, first reference I can find, 5,000 years ago in ancient China. The Mongolians wrote about it, you know, 4,000 years ago. So it seems to have been with us from the beginning. And it seems to be, you know, parts unknown. I mean, obviously, there's theories about where it comes from. But what we find is that these folks are actually, you know, manifesting this. Well, I guess the best way to start it off is by talking about how people usually go through the process. And that's usually found with someone waking up in the middle of the night, usually from some sort of dream that is vivid to the point that it almost seems like a premonition. They wake up with a sense of impending fear or doom, whether for themselves or someone that they love. Someone is about to die is a very common description that I've heard before. And for the first time, they'll see this thing, usually at the end of their bed or somewhere in their room.
Hi, this is Donna. I'm sorry, we had a technical interruption. Power was lost. Tobias, you're still with me, right?
I am still with you.
Great. So we're going to take off on that. Now, you were talking about different things about the hag. Let's move, because I'm sorry we lost the connection. But you talk about the difference between ghosts and zombies here. Now, in Savannah, Why is it that this is so significant? Is it because there is has been an influx of cultures? You have multiple cultures. You have the aspect of the Caribbean. You have the African slaves that were there hundreds of years ago. All of this cultural diversity that has come in from different environments, has that contributed to a lot of these legends? How old is Savannah?
Well, you know, Savannah proper, you know, at least from the colonial standpoint, is, you know, 1733. But, you know, the Yamacraw, you know, Native American tribes were here, you know, 10,000 years ago. And so there's a long history, you know, documented history of Savannah. And then once we got here, you know, being a port city, most people know that Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, but they're not really aware that he did it in Savannah. And so it took us overnight from, you know, this, you know, military encampment to this explosive place of commerce and industry. So yeah, absolutely. We started seeing, you know, slaves, you know, immigrants, you know, coming here to, you know, to eventually settle other parts of the U.S. And it became this one of the first melting pots, I think, really in the United States. So yeah, certainly it has contributed to it.
With so much of this cultural diversity, there was brought in the voodoo, the hoodoo, and of course we got ghosts. And I know the Native Americans have their history too, relative to their own beliefs and their experiences. Well, let's talk about the voodoo, hoodoo, and the ghosts.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because, you know, for as many differences as they have, they're also extremely similar. But, you know, most people, when we talk about the, you know, the Midnight Zombie Tour, you know, people automatically, their minds go to, you know, our popular interpretation of it. But really, we're talking about ghosts when we say zombie, because collectively, the hoodoo, the voodoo, the OB practitioners, you know, in the Lowcountry, it is collectively referred to as conja or conjuring. And they believe in a spiritual and a physical zombie. And we would call a spiritual zombie a ghost. And so we're really saying that it's the Midnight Ghost Tour. We're just using the conjurer's word for it. Mm-hmm. And we see that, and that's where they start to kind of, diverge. You'll find in the colonial mindset, our attitude towards ghosts is that we're either investigating them or typically we are trying to avoid them. And in the conjuring communities, you will find the attitude towards ghosts, particularly at the voodoo village that we visited and write so much about in the book, that they actually embrace it. In fact, they go through willful possession ceremonies there. We had a chance to witness one of those during the death masquerade that they perform there every year. So differences, but also a lot in common as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think you've touched on a point, that the language we use to describe things can vary, but the substance, the essence, is the same. Let's talk about this village that's considered not to be a part of the United States, and they actually have a king, and there are just some very strict policies here. How long has this been around? What is it, and who is the king?
It's been around for about 35 years, and what happened was about 200 families got together, and a gentleman that was raised in Brooklyn, New York, had a chance to visit Africa, and he had become so affected. You know, you and I at the beginning of the program talked about downloads, and you know he received one when he was in Africa, and when he came back, he was determined to bring that authenticity of his roots, you know, back to America. And he ended up settling in a place that already had a large, you know, conjuring, you know, type community, which was obviously the Lowcountry outside of Savannah. Well, he got together and bought the property, and he ended up naming it Oyotunji. And the folks that helped him settle it were, you know, practitioners of what they called the Voodoo cult. And so they get together, they form this community, and it ends up becoming a nonprofit. He changes his name. He becomes Oba Adafume I, and he's actually the first person in North America to be coronated by at least two nations in Africa as a legitimate king.
And he comes back and institutes the old practices, and they begin practicing the voodoo culture there, much as it was done in West Africa. And once he passed away in 2005, he turned it over to his 14th son, who has now become Oba Adefumi II. And now he is the recognized king of that country. And they actually have people from Africa that send their children here to actually study at the village. And they, among other things, they teach, farming and engineering, from the old African perspective. But they also train them in the voodoo priesthood. In fact, the person that we spoke with that participated in the death masquerade, the willful possession ceremony, a lot of those folks were actually from Africa, and they were there helping to implement the old traditions, in a very modern world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating place. I mean, in fact, when you go there and you go down this little bumpy dirt road, I mean, I usually tell people that even in the daylight, it's almost completely dark because of the live oak coverage. And when you get to the end of this road, the first thing that you're met with, and, there's actually a picture of this sign in the book. It says, "You are now leaving the U.S. They do not consider themselves part of the United States, and they are extremely serious about it.
Fascinating, fascinating story. One of the points of association that I have noted, and I don't claim to be a real sophisticated history buff, but cultures around the world seem to share a common denominator. In Brazil, you have the Spiritist application where they very definitely believe in mediumship. That may not be their word, but communication and getting information. They have their various aspects. Africa is just loaded with history. If you talk with anyone that has really done any serious study, like this gentleman you referred to, the history is replete with all kinds of information. And I have to chuckle because people will often say, well, that wasn't with Christianity. I want to say, oh, yes, it was. There is so much that is identical. When you look at different aspects of religion, cultural patterning, belief systems, there is this thread of commonality that goes among all of them. I don't care what costume they may put on in their structure, saying ours is different. It's all there.
Well, and, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, voodoo even has a form of the Trinity, except in their belief system, it's referred to as the Loa, the twins, and the dead. But they do operate in very similar roles to the Christian Trinity, so I completely agree with your point.
Mm-hmm. I just find it amazing. And I find it amazing that people will argue and fight and do all kinds of upheavals because you are not doing what I'm doing. And it's so silly because basically you have this commonality. And I think when it comes to ghosts, I have yet to encounter a culture that doesn't have it. I don't care where you are on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Now, well, go ahead. Well, I was going to say you're absolutely right. And one of the things that I say that if you get information or help or whatever from a disembodied transcendental entity, what do you care what we call it? We could call it an angel. We could call it an alien. And I think the ghost folks and the UFO folks are going to have a talk. I think they're going to have to find some common ground because, there's a dividing line between those two camps. But I suspect that a lot of those anomalies are very closely related or even the same thing.
Many times that's true. But I think as human beings, we want to put things in little boxes. We want to think that we've come up with something new. And in truth, every generation has to rediscover this. And it's not an easy thing to accept because we want to say no. Purple is better than green. No, that's not necessarily true. How do you understand an application? It's really a hard space to get into or to wrap your mind around because you want some kind of exclusivity. I love Elsie. I think Elsie was just a doll. She was weird, but I loved her.
Yeah, Elsie was a hard lady to come by, and it took a long time to get that meeting set up because, She's one of the most respected and one of the most mysterious conjurers in the Lowcountry. She has kind of taken the place of Lady Minerva from Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil fame, and was actually apparently an understudy of Lady Minerva. And, you don't become one of the most respected conjurers in the Lowcountry without making some enemies. And so they are quite often in hiding. And, we know that Lady Minerva, she was usually hidden in a small shanty house, 90 miles north of Savannah in a little place called Dillamo. And Jim Williams from Midnight fame had to go to great lengths to get a meeting with Minerva. And I kind of found some common ground when I tried to meet with Elsie. You would have people that would tell you that they knew how to get in touch with her. They would usually want you to give them money. You would have to hope they're not ripping you off. And then they would introduce you to someone that knew a little more and a little more. And it all ended up being dead ends until I had a very chance meeting with a lady that claimed to be her niece and come to find out she was telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it fascinating? I mean, it's absolutely amazing. A lot of these people of this level of talent. Now, I would call this woman a trance medium. That's the term I would use.
Mm-hmm.
And that she uses bones, that goes back thousands of years in African culture. Throwing the shell. I mean, this is nothing new. But because she, from your description of her and living in an area that most people don't even know exists, it's amazing. And I want to share something with you. Many years ago, when I had started into working publicly as a psychic with people, I had this very tall black woman come to see me, and she was big. And I don't mean obese. This woman, she could have been a warrior. She was about 6'2", big build.
Wow.
I don't know what her African heritage was, but she was American.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
She told me an absolutely amazing story. I only saw her once. And she was very gifted herself. She was very, very talented. And she had been in training with an elderly black man who knew white voodoo. That's what she called it. And he had been trained by someone else. And she had been training under him for years. And she said, people don't realize a lot of what they hear about is maligned process. And this old man who taught her that you had to be responsible. There was a strict code of ethics. And he just wasn't teaching anybody. He was selective in choosing her. And this woman was of such a persona. She was just a wonderful, wonderful person. And I can remember sitting, just listening, mesmerized to her story. So you have, again, this cultural aspect. And people, dependent on their education, will bring tidbits of something along, unless they have a chance to meet with someone that's really been trained. And this has been going on, like I said, with this woman for years. This man did not train her like in 3 weeks with a glass of water and you've got it, kid. No, that wasn't it at all. It took a lot of discipline and a lot of training because you had to have emotional maturity, mental maturity. And I think I met her, and she must have been in her 30s or early 40s. So she had been doing this for a long, long, long time. And I just find your book, Savannah Shadows, so fascinating. And the story of Elsie, very, very interesting. Because I've often said the greatest, that we have three great enemies. One's ignorance, one's fear, and the other is superstition. And if we get stuck at those three, we're in trouble because we're never going to be able to see things clearly. And that's one of the things I like about your book are the various aspects of experience in Savannah Shadows that you have. Now, let's talk a little bit about the history of Savannah. There's no one, it's not a surprise that Savannah has so many ghosts because it is such a historical town and so much of its history has been a bloody history. There was the tremendous breakout of yellow fever. When was that? Was that in the 1700s, 1800s? When did that hit Savannah?
It's hit us innumerable times, but it's hit us 10 times, in a horrific way. In fact, one of the more memorable ones would be the 1820 epidemic that hit us. And, you've got one out of six people that ended up dying from yellow fever that year. We had one of our great fires. We had over 400 buildings destroyed in 2 days. And that yellow fever epidemic, in fact, is an odd little play on numbers here. When they started tracking yellow fever in May of that year, until the end of it, we actually had 666 documented victims from the church. And so as you go around Savannah in Colonial Park Cemetery, there are markers to different yellow fever epidemics to the victims. And in Colonial Park, there is a one for the 1820 victims, and it says dedicated to the nearly 700 people who died. And on the rest of the markers, they'll give the exact number. But because of, you know, man's aversion to, you know, 666, they've actually left it off of the marker and said nearly 700. And it is customarily referred to as the year of the devil in Savannah, in the 1820 epidemic.
Well, let's see. There were literally, though, it wasn't hundreds. It was thousands of people that died.
Well, we're talking about just from May until the end of the year. You know, the yellow fever epidemic continued past 1820, but you know, statistically, they would you know, have a number count yearly as far as the breakdown, and they began tracking it in May, a couple of weeks mm-hmm. after it broke out, and they did it until the end of the year. But yeah, sure, there are, you know, thousands of people. You have, you know, nearly half of the city evacuating. You've got one out of six people that would ultimately die from it that stayed. You had the slave population that was faring much better than the colonial folk because they were using the Haint Blue paint over their doors because they believed that it warded evil away. And what it was really doing,
turpentine in it, didn't it?
Yeah, a key ingredient was turpentine, and it was actually a mosquito repellent. Because, you know, we didn't realize until 1901, I believe, 1900 or 1901, that the mosquito was the vector.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, yeah, if, you know, there have been tens of thousands of people that have died from it over the course of the epidemics that we have suffered. And you're talking about at times when the population was only, you know, 32,000. You know, roughly, and then you've got one out of six people dying from it at stake. So yeah, it was a devastating time for us, especially 1820, when you couple it with the fire. And I think that's the biggest point about Savannah's history in terms of why it's so haunted. It's not just the bloody things; it's the tragic things. We've had so much tragedy here, and I think coupled with that is how we've chosen to deal with it. I don't think we've dealt with it very well. And I love Savannah. I love Savannah. I just think that we have a lot of loose ends in the psychic ether. I think there's a lot of unresolved issues there for us historically.
Oh, I think that goes without saying because of the Civil War and disease and just various aspects of history alone that
the revolutionary conflict.
Oh yes, it's just absolutely amazing. Now, you have got a real good story in here about a bottle of water turning black, and I'm not going to tell the whole story because I think it's cool. People need to get the book to find out more about it. But you also have a story about relatives of Harry Houdini in here, which I thought, now, this is something unexpected.
Yeah, that's it was unexpected for me as well. I met with William Houdini Bradley. He owns Bradley's Lock and Key, and he's actually named after Harry Houdini. His family was very good friends with the Houdini family, and I thought it was so tongue in cheek, you know, that for as long as the Houdini folks have been, you know, escape artists, the Bradleys have been doing locks, you know, locksmith. And I've even heard that they helped design some of the cuffs for Harry Houdini that he used in his escapes. But William Bradley, his father was an accomplished seance man, and he was also a great debunker of charlatans. And he was very good friends with the Houdini family. And after Houdini passed, we know that there were members of the Houdini family that visited. We know that William Bradley's father attempted to contact Harry Houdini. Oftentimes, at least some of them took place in the shop. And this is one of the most curious places you can walk into. It's literally like stepping back into time when you go into this place. And so I couldn't help but to wonder, you know, when they're telling me these tales about the supernatural activity that's experienced there, it was a logical place for me to go to wonder if perhaps, you know, it wasn't the ghost of Harry Houdini. We know that the extended family of Harry Houdini has come and visited Bradley's Lock and Key, maybe trying to discern the presence. But at the very least, we know that they came there to talk to the Bradleys about Harry, to get some insight into his private life and to his last days. So it's a very, very interesting place.
Absolutely.
Very fascinating. Yeah.
Fascinating. Tobias, I know we're out of time, and it has been just a delight. Your book is really a good read. The photographs in it are terrific. And you have a website, blueorbtours.com. People will find out more about what you do. But for those of you listening, if you are a history buff, this book will be of interest to you. If you like stories of the odd, the bizarre, the unusual, going to be a lot of it in Savannah Shadows. And you will learn about the mysterious Room 204. Also, well, the Weeping Square and a little bit more. Tobias Shadows, McGriff, excuse me. I had Shadows written down here. Tobias McGriff, this has just been so much fun. I think you've done an incredible job.
Thanks so much.
And it's a delight having you as a guest. I'm sorry we had the technical situation, but that's okay. We got through it, and it's been wonderful.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for just a moment. When we come back, we'll share some more good things with you. Don't forget, check out blueorbtours.com. Savannah Shadows, Tobias McGriff has been my guest. We'll be right back.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Have you ever wanted to be in an environment of people with unique psychic abilities? There's a special event taking place on September 15th at 6 p.m. at the Roosevelt Hotel in Seattle, Washington, that will give you that opportunity. Dr. Pat Basile will be the guest speaker for this healing program. Michael Shane and Monty Burgess will be demonstrating their individual talents and mediumship in music, answering questions you might have. There will be a silent and live auction, wine tasting, and much more for you to enjoy. This fundraising event is for the healing and educational programs of the Ascension Foundation. Awaken to love and experience the gifts from spirit. Cost per person, $75. To pre-register or for more details, call 800-508-6437 or email info@michaelshane.com. This is a one-of-a-kind event you won't want to miss. Call now, 800-508-6437. Donna Sebo here. Welcome. The telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. If you would like to chat with me, if you're a first-time listener, all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, I will be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of insight. And just again, give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. Billy Graham, who's known by millions around the world, said, if a person gets his attitude towards money straight, it will straighten out almost every other area in his life. Attitude about money. Wow, that is something that so many people have a challenge with. And it's an interesting challenge because when you look at things historically, money is just a representation of a medium of exchange. If you lived in certain cultures, it would have been shells like wampum that the Indians traded. Or it could have been beads, or it could have been cows, or it could have been gigantic stones. You know, there's just no end to what we can do as a form of exchange. Personally, I appreciate the dollar bill better. It's a lot lighter, and it doesn't smell, so it's really good. Well, maybe it could smell. Depends on the circumstances, but you can always put it through the laundry if you want. It is really interesting how sometimes we get ourselves all tied up in the knots. I know it's happened to me, and I'm sure it's happened to you. So what is it that we need to do? We are going through so many changes that lots of times fear comes in, and it's a fear of lack. How do you switch that? What do you do when you reach what you consider a locked-in positioning when it comes to money and the value? Well, the first thing is to change thinking and realize that the universe is very, very abundant. There really is no lack. And just like someone once told me, there's just as much water on the planet at this time as there has ever been. It just is in different places. So what it takes is a shift in our thinking, recognizing that we don't have to be a part of lack. We don't have to be experience the lack. But we have to be in a flow of an attitude and a feeling and a perception of prosperity. And it's amazing how that can occur. There was a member of my family that went to visit a friend who owns a business. And at this business, there was an individual. This person is extremely talented. This man has a background that's just amazing. But when this member of family was talking to this person, because it was suggested that he do that, to his dismay, in a way, he found that every time he made a suggestion to the individual would say, no, that's not going to work. No, that's not going to work. They were in a mind lock. That's how I will describe it. A mind lock. They were so attached to what had happened to them, they didn't know how to move beyond it. They really wanted to own their misery. Now, that sounds cold, but it happens. And I've experienced this so many times in my counseling with people where they actually want to own their misery. And someone says, oh, well, that's not possible. But how long do you hang on to it? And, you know, many times we own our misery because we feel like we need to punish ourselves. We human beings are really quite complicated in many respects. But at the same time, it could be very, very simple. I've watched people because of guilt, anger, resentment, many times ignorance, hanging on to stuff that they need to liberate themselves from. Let me share a story with you, and this is a true story. This is about a man that I don't remember his name. This goes back a few years. He was a very, very wealthy businessman. And I mean, this guy had millions and millions of dollars. And he had everything. He really did. He had yachts. He had beautiful women around him. He had everything. But something inside of him was not healthy. Something inside of him was not well. He started to drink. He became a severe alcoholic. He lost everything. The woman that he loved more than anything else in the world left him. She said, I can't watch this destruction, and I just can't be a part of it. He ended up living on the streets. and on the streets at a certain level, really at the basest level, you really don't care about anything. You're just so self-centered. Hardcore alcoholic. And if you've been around someone like that, you know how ugly it can be. Well, one day, he's rooting around in an area of the city that he had obtained his wealth through, and now he was a bum on the street. He heard someone call his name. He turns around, and his name was called again. And this person said, "I'll call the guy Harry." "Harry, is that you? Harry so-and-so?" And he just looked at him, didn't even respond, pushed the guy aside, walks away. Something clicked inside of him. Now, he had been on the street for years. This isn't something where he had just been there for a week. He knew the dark, darker, and the darkest. He had been there for quite a while. I think it was almost 10 years. And that particular episode grabbed his psyche. And he happened to walk by a store window, and he looked at his reflection. And in that moment, he changed his mind. He said, "What have I done to myself?" I didn't blame anybody else. He asked the question, "What have I done to myself?" Now, what happened is that in that moment, in that split second, he woke up. And he went and sought for help. He went to, it was either Salvation Army or Goodwill, one of those groups that are there for those in need. And he went in, he got a shower, and he decided to shave and get his life together. Now, there was a wonderful ending to this story because this man got in touch with his ex-wife after he had cleaned up his act. He was working, he was doing things, and he cleaned up his act, and he became wealthy again. But this man would go and talk to groups and organizations and say that the reason he really had to dig deep, the reason that he went to such depths of despair and lived such a dark, ugly period of his life, he said he really had to figure out what it was. Why was it that he did such a level of self-destruction? He said because he didn't feel he was worthy. Very simple, yet complex. So when we go through life, we need to realize that who we are makes a difference. How we think, what we surround ourselves with, what we put our energy into makes a difference. And this man was a living example of this. And Harry went on eventually to reunite with his ex-wife. She had never been married. And she was astonished at the change in him. But the change had to come from within him. A lot of people have tried to help him. No. So it has to come from inside. And I wanted to share that with you because I think it's important to realize that we may aspire to be wealthy, we may aspire to be anything, but you know, you really are wealthy when you've been given the gift of life. And you all have talents, you all have abilities. So it's what you do with it. It's how you feel about yourself, how you feel about being a contributor into life. And it can be done in so many different ways. So I hope you will have an attitude of gratitude about what you've got in your life and where it is that you want to be and what it is you want to do. Because that very desire means that you have the capability of achieving it. And the adventure is doing it. This is Donna Sebo. I know we're going to go on a break in just a moment. And if you'd like to give me a buzz, won't you? It's at 888-627-6008. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about how you can be unstoppable. Gail K. Casper will be my guest. And then we're going to be talking about today's historic interiors, Ashley Rooney, architectural design. We'll be talking about all kinds of things, jailhouses, et cetera, and how they've been remade. And then Robert Rose is going to be my guest this week, Abuses of Power in Education. A fascinating man, a man who absolutely has a passion for teaching and working with kids. Amazing guy. So anyway, we've got a very eclectic lineup this week, which is not unusual for the Donna Sebo Show, and I hope you'll tell your friends and join us. Let's take a break. And when I come back, I'm going to have a recipe for you that's really quick, and also a story about dogs who can sense cancer. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Quick like a bunny, I wanted to share a recipe for coleslaw with you. I love coleslaw. I love cabbage, period. But there's something about that crunchy, munchy coleslaw, and there's so many variations of what you can do with coleslaw, but it's great with barbecue, it's great with chicken. I mean, I don't care what you serve it with, it's really nice. But this one I like because it has a touch of the spicy, and I like spice. We have a touch of the spicy along with the sweet, so it gives a bit of a different, well, crunch and that I think you'll want to experience more than once. But it's so, so easy. This is what you're going to do. You need 3 tablespoons each of olive oil and apple cider vinegar, 3 tablespoons each of olive oil and apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon of honey, and 1/2 teaspoon of green jalapeno pepper sauce, like green Tabasco. Personally, I'd use the red. The green Tabasco is too weak for me. I don't like it. But if you're one just wants a touch of the heat, use the green. 1/2 teaspoon of salt. You're going to need 6 cups of freshly grated coleslaw. And of course, you can always buy it, a mix that has the carrots and all of that at your grocery store. And that would be about a pound package, and this will do very nicely. You're going to need 2 scallions sliced, about 1/2 cup. And I'd say slice them real thinly. 1/3 cup of golden raisins, 1/4 cup of chopped fresh mint. And 1/4 cup of toasted slivered almonds. And you can toast the almonds really fast. Just put them in a pan and just let them slide across until they start to get brown. And what it does, it creates an aroma when you pan roast like that. And it just gives a wonderful taste to those almonds when you put them in the salad. So simple, absolutely. In a big bowl, you whisk together your oil, your vinegar, your honey. I think I put in 1 tablespoon of honey in there. If I missed it, then I'll put it back in. Your pepper sauce and your salt. Easy. Add your coleslaw, your scallions, your raisins, mint, and almonds. Toss until coated, and you're ready to go. It is absolutely marvelous. And you can fix the dressing in advance if you're going to have company. Fix it in advance. Keep it in a little jar in the refrigerator, and when you're ready to serve the coleslaw, slice it up fresh if you want. Shake it. And the dressing, and you're ready to go. But I love that. I just, the sweet hot is just a flavor that I don't think that you have a chance to experience very often. I want to also say, Awaken to Love, Gifts from Spirit, for those of you in Washington State, an incredible event is happening on September 15th at 6 p.m. at the Roosevelt Hotel in Seattle. A fundraiser for the Ascension Foundation's Healing and Educational Programs. Guest speaker, Dr. Pat Basile, leads the program. You'll be able to receive messages from loved ones with Monty Burgess. Also, you're going to see Michael Shane, an internationally renowned apport medium. He's going to demonstrate his amazing skills of materializing objects. A lot more is going to be happening, including a silent auction and wine tasting you'll be able to enjoy. Tickets are $75 a person. To re-register for more details, contact 800-508-6437. That's 800-508-6437. A one-of-a-kind event you won't want to miss. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. I have this fabulous story about dogs, and it's about melanoma, but it's more than just about melanoma. There was a letter sent to an editor in 1989 by two London dermatologists, and a patient had said, "I've been sent to you by my dog." Now, the woman had a dark spot on her upper leg that the doctor said was a mole. It was just slightly raised. It was no big deal. And they said it was made dark by a high concentration of melanin. They said this bore the signs it just needed to be removed. Now, the woman, when she received this diagnosis, she was happy with it. It wasn't a problem. However, her dog, who was a half border collie, half Doberman pincher, kept going to her leg and sniffing it. And she would actually, if her mistress was sitting somewhere, she would stick her nose under the mistress's skirt and go right to that mole. It bothered this woman terribly. Well, of course it would. This is not normal behavior. But the dog wouldn't stop. And she said, "Okay, I've just got a problem with my dog here." However, when she was out in the garden, it was a summer day, she was out in the garden, she was wearing shorts, and her dog tried to bite the mole. The mole, because she was wearing shorts, was easily reached by the dog. And she said, "My dog has never, ever bitten me before." But she didn't do it. She went after that mole. So she said, "All right, I've got to pay attention. My dog is doing something that's totally out of character and out of behavior, because this is not her normal patterning." So the doctors ended up, at her insistence, removing the mole, sending it to the lab for a biopsy, and it came back positive. It was cancerous, obviously, malignant melanoma, measuring 1.86 in thickness. It was an extremely deadly type of skin cancer, and it could have spread rapidly and killed her if she had not gone in to have it removed. And these two researchers, Drs. H. William and A. Pembroke, said this dog may have saved her owner's life by prompting her to seek treatment when the lesion was at a thin and curable stage. Their conclusion at that time was that there was a scent that the dog was able to identify, and they wanted to do some studies. Well, there's more to this story, and I'll continue it at another time. This is Donna Siebel. I know we're just about out of time. It's been delightful sharing this hour with you. Thank you for joining me. And remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Do not turn your mind or attitudes over to any other circumstances, any other person. Realize you're the boss. Take charge of them. Shift them so that your life will be more of what you want it to be. And don't stop reaching for the dreams. Donna Siebel here. See you back tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.